This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Cry Havoc, written by A. American, performed by Duke Fontaine. Prologue. Election time in the United States of America is a long, drawn-out exposé of unrestrained spending and a non-stop bombardment of ads. There once was a time when the media reported on the election cycle. But in today's America, the media is simply another arm of the two parties. No longer are there unbiased reports on the good, the bad, and the ugly of a candidate. Now, all those talking heads on the TV and radio are merely pundits of their preferred candidate. The presidential election of 2016 was no different. As had been the trend in recent elections, it was worse than the one before. The election of Obama saw a vicious competition that many thought witnessed the depth of depravity that candidates could sink to. But this election proved that wrong in a big way. Sadly, what it foreshadowed was the continuing trend of the nation being divided further and further. Oh, each candidate always proclaimed they were the one to unite the country. But in every case, they merely pandered to the most radical elements of their respective parties. No one, at least in recent memory, was about uniting the country. It was about winning power, seizing power for their party. It was, in their minds, to reward their supporters and punish their adversaries. And that was the real change in the mindset, to punish those that opposed them. Obama was the first president to speak this out loud. But he didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk as well, using many federal agencies to serve up retribution on those he saw as enemies. He utilized the IRS, the Justice Department, and even the Department of Agriculture. All of these were viewed as useful tools or weapons to the new president and those in his administration. And they used them to their most utmost effectiveness. So, the election of 2016 simply moved the nation further down the path of division, resentment, and hate. It was no surprise, then, that successive administrations would be worse than the previous, though each time the current election was always called the worst one yet. And it was. It was as if there were some sick race to the bottom of human nature. Like some abhorrent game those in power would continue to implement in order to see just how far they could manipulate the population of the richest nation in the world. The real goal of all of this was to push the country farther and farther to the left. Those on the right were always portrayed as extremists. Not that the typical individual of a left-leaning mindset saw their neighbors with a right-leaning mindset as extremists. But they were very carefully herded in that direction. America was formed on the concept of individual worth, and that simply could not be tolerated in what those in power foresaw for the country. In order to achieve their goals, they had to change this. It was started in the schools to ensure that the next generations didn't hold on to archaic ideas. Anyone who held on to these out-of-date values was berated publicly. They were humiliated and accused of any and all crimes, real or not. The masses had to be brought into line. Social conditioning is a very complex process, and social media plays a major role in that in this modern world. People can't hide from their accusers or their accusations, whether they are fabricated or not. And these social justice warriors played a significant part. They were recruited to shout down any dissenting voices. In the new America, there could only be one line of thought, and that was whatever those in power wanted it to be. Those Americans who were more independent, more self-reliant, stood to lose the most. And to ensure these people, as well as everyone else, came to heel, three things had to be controlled. First was the possession of firearms. An armed populace possesses the ability to resist, which is precisely what Thomas Jefferson and the other founding fathers intended when they crafted the Second Amendment. But that simply does not fit with the new narrative. Second was money, the medium of exchange. The ability of people to purchase what they need, when they need it, and from the source of their choice, had to be restricted. To that end, the removal of cash from circulation had to be carried out for the overall plan to be effective. But it was understood that simply couldn't happen overnight. The last point of manipulation, in order to realize absolute domination of the population, would be the total command over communications. People who can communicate and share ideas or plan and coordinate are not as easy to subjugate as those whose only source of information comes from those seeking power over them. The election of 2020 was set to further all of these goals, just as those elections prior to it had done. But things were progressing too slowly for those at the helm, and something had to be implemented to speed it up. With this in mind, the triangle of freedom in the United States would become the first leg of the assault. The top of the new president's agenda was to push the House and Senate to ratify the Small Arms Treaty. Oh, there was a great outrage from the reps on the right. Lots of pulpit pounding and chest thumping. But in the end, it passed both chambers with a nearly 90% yes vote. This was gasoline on the fire. The second act of the new president was to capitulate to Iran and acknowledge their right to self-defense, and in that light, their right to nuclear weapons. This process had already been started by Obama. The new occupant of the White House just laid the capstone. And with Iran firmly in Russia's pocket, things would certainly only get worse. When the U.S. accidentally bombed elements of the Syrian army, claiming they thought they were ISIS, the Russians moved in missile systems capable of shooting down American aircraft, as well as cruise missiles. The pieces were being set for a head-to-head confrontation with Russia. Russia was not going to allow Assad to fall, no matter how bad the new president of the United States wanted it. Further emboldened by the perceived support of Russia, radicals in the Middle East pressed their campaigns of terror and fear throughout the world. Israel was under near constant attack from the West Bank. When ISIS was finally defeated, despite the best efforts of the Obama and Clinton administrations, Iran was even further empowered. Hezbollah began direct action operations against Israel. Of course, publicly, they denied this. But with the full backing of the Russians, there was little the world could do to combat it, short of full-scale world war. The trail to destruction was thus begun. Oh, there were other potholes along the way, but these events were to have such a profound effect on the country that it would be forever changed. When Obama knelt at the feet of the Persians, figuratively, if not literally, it emboldened the Iranian leadership. When the president proposed a further reduction in nuclear arsenals with the Russians, the government of Putin eagerly agreed. A great victory in the name of humanity was made out of the decommissioning of upwards of 60% of the U.S. and Russian arsenals. The Russians played up the plan in the media, and appearances between the two leaders were plastered all over the MSM. The Russians, however, were not decommissioning anything. Under the Small Arms Treaty, it was announced to the nations of the world that the private ownership of military-grade weapons was now outlawed. Much was made that America, reputed to be the last superpower, had the greatest number of such weapons in private hands. The fact that the U.S. administration ratified the treaty, then went even further by reducing its nuclear arsenal, heralded a new era in global peace, while at the same time continuing to bang the drums of war. The rest of the world may have bought this, but the owners of the more than 300 million guns in the U.S. certainly didn't. And here, another wedge was driven into the nation. There are many gun owners in the country that certainly believe military-grade hardware should be outlawed. They join the applause of the treaty. Those that believed that high-capacity magazines should be outlawed joined into the orgy of praise as well. That is, until it was revealed that supplemental wording was added that banned any weapon that was capable of mechanical self-loading. In the beginning, this caused some confusion and misconceptions. When it was revealed that any magazine-fed weapon, regardless of capacity, was banned, the cries of violating the Constitution grew louder. When it was further revealed that the term magazine also included tube-fed weapons, the cries reached a crescendo. Now, there was no doubt what the intentions behind this treaty were: the virtual total disarmament of the American people. The events happening around the globe faded from the minds of most Americans. So caught up in their fading freedoms, they paid less and less attention to what was happening on a global scale. And while they wouldn't pay attention for now, a time was fast approaching when they would no longer be able to ignore it. For many in the prepper community, the writing was on the wall. All across the country, people were making decisions. Some were headed to their BOLs, while others were trying to buy up whatever ammo was left out there. And prices were astronomical. There would be no more shipments, no more mags, no more parts, nothing. All those people that figured they would see it coming and head out and use their credit cards to prepare were caught with their pants down, and Big Brother was squeezing Astroglide into his hand. When the TSA started to set up roadblocks and search vehicles, the shit hit the fan. The feds decided to go big. Many people were caught off guard by the TSA being the ones to man these roadblocks, but the ice had already been broken on that issue years ago. Of course, it was called training for terror operations back then. The feds just didn't mention who those terrorists would be. We the people. The first roadblocks were set up in Michigan. It was bait, and the Michigan militia took it. When the militia heard that the TSA goons were searching people on the interstates, confiscating and arresting people for possession of firearms, even though the grace period wasn't up, they made their move. A unit of the militia planned a quick op when they heard of a roadblock nearby. Using 6 vehicles, they approached the roadblock from both directions. This particular roadblock was on a frontage road that paralleled Highway 96 outside of Lansing. The lead car had 2 militiamen in it. As they approached the roadblock, they were challenged by the TSA and asked if they had any weapons. When they replied they did, they were ordered from the car. Both of them were wearing body armor with plates, front and back. Most of the attention of those manning the roadblock was focused on the 2 non-compliant passengers. It was then that the other 25 members emerged from the remaining 5 SUVs and opened fire on the TSA, DHS, and State Patrol officers at the roadblock. The incident would forever be referred to as the Lansing Incident. It would be a battle cry for the patriots of the nation and the anvil against which all freedom-loving men and women of the U.S. would be hammered. 4 militiamen were killed, as well as 2 troopers, 2 DHS personnel, and 4 from the TSA. The firefight was intense and short. Almost all the vehicles at the scene belonging to any of the agencies involved were burned through the use of homemade thermite grenades. The militia managed to escape from the scene, recovering their fallen comrades. Not all of them were caught, although the MSM would report otherwise. This was our Concord, the spark that started it all. America was now a police state. And to make matters worse, America was also about to go to war. This was the moment the administration was waiting for. Before the fires were even out in Lansing, the Attorney General was issuing decrees to local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. All weapons in private hands were to be seized immediately. To get around any constitutional or legal loopholes, the president enacted several executive orders, not the least of which was 13603, Section 501, that was to have a profound effect on the citizens of the nation. This particular section of the EO was headed by employment of personnel and allowed the establishment of the National Executive Defense Reserve, or NADER. It was created under the auspices of training civilians in executive-level positions in the federal government. In reality, it was a cover to create a private, federal police force, answerable only to the president and the attorney general. KLB Inc. was awarded an indefinite delivery contract to provide for detention and housing of suspects and subversives, utilizing the guidelines established in the NDAA. The National Defense Authorization Act allowed for the indefinite detention of American citizens without any constitutional protections. The Council of Governors was instructed to assist the DHS with the activation of the regional FEMA camps. These camps would be used to house persons arrested under provisions of the NDAA. Soon, American citizens would be facing American troops on the streets of the nation. That is, unless their attention gets focused elsewhere. Chapter 1. Daniel Taylor lived in a four-story apartment on Century Circle off of I-85 on the north side of Atlanta. He worked in the IT department of one of the banks in the upscale Buckhead area, and attended the University of Phoenix DeKalb Learning Center across the street from his apartments. In his position, he was responsible for keeping the network secure from the constant daily attacks on the bank. He was one of the many who lived in cubicle land, staring into computer monitors all day. Once he finishes his degree, he hopes to get promoted out of the gopher farm and upstairs. But for now, this was his life. While cyber attacks on banks were nothing new, things were really getting bad lately. He and the others tasked with securing the bank's servers from attacks were barely able to keep up. And it wasn't just them. In white papers that circulated through the IT world, it was now openly acknowledged that the early stages of war were already in motion. Power plants, utility providers, banks, traffic networks, military and law enforcement networks across the nation were under constant and crippling attacks. While it wasn't stated publicly, those in the industry knew where the attacks were coming from. The daily power outages occurring around the country were reported as brownouts due to excessive demand. The summer was exceptionally hot, and people were trying to stay cool. While that was the official story, the real reason was the number of cyber attacks on the various utility providers. Not only power companies and infrastructure, but water operations as well, and even internet and phone providers. The attacks were sufficiently widespread that most people didn't acknowledge them for what they were: a coordinated attack on the U.S. In the modern world, warfare extends into the cyber world. Daniel's girlfriend, Christy, lived nearby in a different apartment. She had hinted several times at wanting to move in together, but so far, he'd been successful in dodging that particular bullet. He wasn't ready for any sort of a commitment. He liked his freedom, and from the talks around the water cooler and the employee lounge, married life came with way too damn many restrictions for him. He enjoyed his weekends in North Georgia, where he camped, hiked, and fished. He liked his time in places like the Bowman's Island Unit of the Chattahoochee River. This is where he got away from the hustle and bustle of Atlanta. Up there, it was quieter, and there were fewer people. On the weekends, he would load his van up and head out of town with his camping gear and a cooler, not to return until sometime Sunday afternoon. Sometimes, Christy would go with him. She wasn't much of a camper, but was learning to like it. Watching the sunset from the top of a ridge, or the sun rising over a secluded pond, made it worth the trip. Most of the time, however, he was alone, and that was how he liked it. The van was something he could never have afforded. It was left to him by a friend of his father when he passed. Old Tom Maples used to love to run the woods with Daniel, and the two became great friends. Tom bought the Sportsmobile customized van late in life, and the two used it extensively. It was a Ford van with a diesel engine and a Quigley 4x4 added to it. It was set up to sleep two people and included an outside shower and an enclosed toilet inside. It was the ideal vehicle for Daniel's weekend forays into the mountains. All through the election, things in Atlanta got progressively worse, culminating in riots. The National Guard was brought in to put them down after the police were overwhelmed. This caused even more riots and problems. Two guardsmen were shot and killed and their weapons stolen. The result was for the governor to authorize the guard troops to shoot armed individuals and looters on sight. 17 people were killed, 14 of them black, which just added fuel to the fire of racial inequality. The world was coming apart at the seams while the band played on. Daniel let out an evil laugh as he jumped and slapped the sign that indicated the elevator. He packed into the first elevator that stopped on his floor. From the looks on the faces of the people already on it, they were not happy with one more person squeezing on. He simply smiled and edged his way in. When the doors opened in the lobby, he was first one off and made a mad dash for the parking garage. Traffic was a nightmare, as is typical for any part of Metro Atlanta, and especially in Buckhead. While he was ready to get home and load up, he wasn't letting it get to him. Where he was headed, there wouldn't be any traffic. The one thing he did notice was all the police on the road. On his ride home, Daniel saw more Atlanta cops, state troopers, and sheriff deputies than he ever had. Several times, he saw these officers putting people in handcuffs and stuffing them in the back of their car. It seemed like the number of people being arrested was increasing. Daniel flipped on the radio, looking for a distraction. He was scanning through the stations, looking for something to listen to that wouldn't drive him nuts. The radio stopped on one of the local talk stations, and Rush Limbaugh was on. He was ranting and raving about how the Republicans had completely caved on Israel, how they were done. They would never be a viable party again. Well, this certainly wasn't helping his sanity, so he punched a key on the radio and smiled as Kid Rock's Cocky started. His cell phone rang. Looking down at Christie's name on the screen, a smile came across his face. He tapped the screen. "Hey, sexy." This was his standard answer. "Hey, babe, where are you?" "Stuck on 85, sitting in traffic. Where are you?"
"At my apartment."
"What are you wanting to do this weekend? I was kind of hoping we could go to Buckhead tonight. You know, take me out to do what I want, and then we can do what you want."
Christie's voice trailed off into a breathy, seductive tone.
"Well, now that was an offer he had to think about.
I was hoping to head up north and check out that trail we found the last time we were up there."
He didn't say anything more than that, not, "Do you want to come?" or anything. He was going to have to see what sort of mood she was in.
"Oh, come on, baby. We haven't gone out in like forever. I want to go out. Take me out tonight, please."
Christie cooed into the phone.
Daniel's hand fell into his lap, and he looked up through the sunroof of the van, his mouth hanging open. In his mind, he was screaming, why, why? But he knew he couldn't say that to her. He hated to go out bar hopping. Going to clubs and being dragged out onto the dance floor was simply not his thing. But he liked Christy, for a couple of reasons. That last thought brought him back around, and he put the phone back to his ear.
Sure, babe, we can go out. I need to get home and get a shower and change. Just come over when you're ready, he finally said.
The conversation didn't last much longer than that. Christy was excited at the thought of spending the night in Buckhead, while Daniel was miserable at the same thought. Then he smiled, knowing the hours he would spend slogging through the bars and clubs would be worth it when they got back to his place. He finally made it home and into his apartment on the second floor, closing the door with an audible sigh. His first order of business was to get out of the corporate monkey suit and into something more comfortable, so he headed for his bedroom and returned wearing a t-shirt and shorts, and feeling far more relaxed. He knew Christy would be a couple, hell, more than a couple, hours before she showed up, so he grabbed a beer and turned on the TV. Fox News and CNN were running talking heads from opposite sides of the gun debates, and MSNBC was interviewing some clown from the EU who was pontificating about the US's role in the global economy and how they weren't acting very responsibly. None of this was doing anything to improve his mood, though, and he flipped to the guide and found Jackass the Movie, which was exactly the sort of mind-numbing entertainment he wanted. Daniel decided to start getting ready, turning up the volume on Johnny Knoxville's antics as he headed for the shower. He was sitting on the couch, watching a piece about Rommel on the military channel, when he heard that distinct knock on the door. He flipped off the TV and grabbed his keys and wallet before heading towards the door. Opening the door, he was greeted with an amazing sight. Christy had one arm resting on the doorframe over her head. She was wearing what is often referred to as the little black dress, little being the key word, and she was smoking hot in it. Adding in the black heels and the fact that the small dress barely contained her chest, he questioned in his mind the plan of going out, thinking that staying at his place would be better. But then, if he took her out and let her party it up, it would certainly pay off.
Damn, you look fine, Daniel said as he stepped towards her.
Christy wrapped her arms around his neck and smiled, revealing her beautifully perfect white teeth. Then she pushed herself up on her toes and leaned in and kissed him.
You don't look so bad yourself, she said with a smile.
Stepping back to check him out,
and all by yourself, I'm so proud.
Daniel did a little pirouette.
Not bad, huh?
Christy reached out and grabbed his ass. Not bad at all. So, where are we going? He had planned what he would say to this question.
I thought we would start at Churchill's.
Before he even finished saying it, he started to smile, knowing how she felt about the British-style pub. Christy spun and started to walk towards the stairs, tossing the little black purse over her shoulder.
I'll pretend I didn't hear that.
They started the night at Aria Restaurant, off East Paces Ferry Road, a trendy, upscale little place with great food and prices that reflect it. Daniel knew this night was going to cost him, but since he wasn't going to the woods this weekend, he was going to make it as enjoyable as possible. And keeping Christy in bed all weekend would certainly be enjoyable. They enjoyed their dinner, he having salmon, and Christy a chicken something or other. Because of the difference in dishes, they had two different bottles of wine at the table as well. Neither of them wanted dessert, and Daniel quickly paid the bill, and they were off to find some music and people. Daniel was pulling out of the parking lot when he asked Christy where she wanted to go.
Her reply was no help. Surprise me. All he could do was roll his eyes as he pulled out onto the road. This scenario had entered his mind, and having been a Boy Scout, he was ready. He headed down Pace's Ferry to Piedmont and made a left. The stars were lining up tonight, and a car was pulling out of a spot in front of the Havana Club as he pulled in. Looking over at Christie, he asked, "Feel like dancing tonight?" His eyebrows jumping up and down as he did. Christie was obviously surprised. Being a typical guy, he tried to avoid dancing at all costs. And for him to suggest it was certainly a surprise. "You mean you're actually going to dance with me tonight?" Daniel looked over at her as he put the van in park. The small silver chain she wore around her neck caught his eye, the little pendant resting in the top of her ample cleavage. He looked a little lower until his eyes settled on the little black dress, covering his desires. He reached across to her seat and laid his hand on her thigh, running it slightly up her leg under the dress. "You look amazing tonight. Want to dance?" Christie took a deep breath, her mouth slightly open, and began to vigorously nod her head. "Yeah, oh yeah, let's go." Inside the bar was packed with all the young and beautiful of Atlanta. Techno dance music filled the place, and bodies on the floor writhed to the rhythm. As soon as Christie broke the plane of the door, her arms went up and she began to shake her ass to the music. They spent the next several hours dancing and drinking. Christie was having a great time, and he knew he would later. It was the only thing that kept him going. Daniel needed a break from the dance floor and told Christie he was going to get them a drink. She nodded and turned back to the gyrating crowd. Daniel went to the bathroom to take a leak. Of course there was an attendant in there, an older black man sitting on a stool. Daniel saw him when he came in and rolled his eyes. After finishing his business at the urinal, he went to the sink. The soap dispenser was gone, and the old man held out a bottle of liquid soap. Daniel stuck his hands out, and the old guy pumped a few squirts in his palm. As he washed his hands, he looked over to the paper towel dispenser, and just as he suspected, it was empty. A smirk ran across his face. When he finished, the old man tossed him a hand towel, and he dried his hands. Sitting on the counter was a small basket full of bills. He handed the towel back to the old guy, and he tossed it into the basket on the floor. It was now that he was expected to tip this guy for some soap and a towel. The old man was smiling at him. Daniel looked at him, patting his pockets. "Sorry, man, don't have any cash. I'm going to the bar for some drinks, and I'll take care of you next time." "Just don't forget about me," the old guy said with a wink. Daniel left the restroom, shaking his head at the thought of having to pay to take a piss, and he fought his way to the bar. He was trying to get the attention of one of the hot bartenders, which appeared impossible, so he occupied his time with one of the huge TVs behind the bar. A local news anchor was on the screen. Behind her was a line of riot police forming a skirmish line. Daniel was absent-mindedly watching when the scroll at the bottom of the screen said, "Riot at Tower Place turns violent." He immediately left the bar, headed for the dance floor to find Christie. He found her dancing with some Latin guy with no shirt. He wedged in between them, and she threw her arms around his neck and kissed him. Pulling away from her, he shouted over the music, "We gotta go!" She was still smiling and dancing to the music. "What?" she shouted back. "We gotta go!" he shouted again. She simply smiled back at him, grabbing his hands and pulling him towards her. Daniel gripped her right hand and pulled her from the dance floor. She tried to protest, pulling away. "What the hell?" Christie asked. "Look, there's a riot starting over at Tower Place. We need to get the hell out of here before they bring in the National Guard and start shooting people." "Why? That's blocks from here. Come on, come back out and dance with me."
No, I'm leaving. I'm not getting caught in that shit. You coming? Daniel asked. The tone of his voice, or maybe his posture, drove the point home.
Fine.
Daniel led her out of the club and to the van. He was putting her in on the passenger side when she wrapped her arms around him again. Christy pulled him to her and started to kiss him. But the sounds of a police helicopter flying low overhead brought Daniel's attention back to more pressing concerns, even if they weren't as enjoyable as what was happening. Backing away from her, he said,
"Hold that thought. Let's get out of here first."
She leaned back into her seat and smiled, closing her eyes. Daniel looked in the direction of Tower Place, at the glow rising above the buildings. Sirens filled the air, as well as police and news helicopters. All he wanted to do was get back to his apartment as fast as he could. By the time he got around the van and into the driver's seat, Christy was passed out, her head slumped over on the door. He pulled out of the parking lot and headed back towards the apartment. Traffic was building, and police were beginning to shut down intersections. Daniel was forced to take several turns he didn't want to, and as a result, he was getting farther and farther from his apartment. What should have been a 20-minute drive ended up taking over an hour and a half. Daniel never saw any trouble. He never got close enough to whatever was going on to see, and that was fine with him. Pulling into the parking garage, he managed to wake Christy up without too much trouble and helped her get to the elevator and into the apartment. Once inside, Christy sat on the edge of his bed and he went into the bathroom. For a moment, he leaned on the sink, looking into the mirror. He wanted to get out of town this weekend, out into the woods, and not let her talk him into staying here, especially now there was a freaking riot. He quickly washed his face and kicked his shoes off, trying to relax. Opening the door, he saw her lying naked on the bed, propped up on her elbows. The light from the bathroom lit her side facing him, and a smile spread across his face. Maybe staying here wasn't such a bad idea, he thought, as he stepped towards the bed. Daniel woke up with light streaming through the blinds in the morning. Shielding his eyes with his hand, he sat up, and then he closed them again. Christy was lying there, sound asleep. She looked so good. Running a hand over her ass, he covered her with the sheet and headed for the kitchen. He needed his hangover remedy. Not that he drank that much, but the combination of the alcohol, the music, and the stress of the ride home made him feel like he drank an entire liquor store. After taking two Excedrin and drinking a huge glass of water, Daniel went to the fridge and dug out some cream cheese. From a paper bag on the counter, he pulled out a huge everything bagel, then looked inside and found a plain one. With his bagel fixed, he headed for the living room and dropped onto the couch, flipping on the TV. He changed the channel to Fox News to see what was going on in the world. What he saw shocked him. On the screen was a view of Tower Place. Cars were on fire, as well as some buildings in the distance. It looked as though there were hundreds of police, but unlike last night, these were not riot cops. The shields and clubs were gone, replaced with armored vehicles and rifles. The reporter on the scene was saying something about an unknown number killed in the fighting. He sat up on the sofa, leaning forward. In the background of the view, it appeared that a large section of the area was blocked off, and there were bodies visible in a couple of places. The reporter came back into view again, and he could see she was crouching behind the corner of a building as the cameraman leaned out to get shots of the action. Gunshots could be heard in the audio. The camera bounced and jerked with each report. Daniel sat there shaking his head. "People are fucking nuts," he said to himself. Watching what was unfolding before him, he started to get a little nervous and got up, returning to the kitchen. He felt like he should be doing something, but what?
The riot was still pretty far from his place and shouldn't be a problem, but better safe than sorry. Daniel went through the cabinets, really quick, to get an idea of what he had on hand. Being a bachelor, naturally, they were pretty bare. Deciding it would be a good idea to have a little more on hand, he figured a trip to the store wouldn't hurt. Back in the bedroom, he tried to wake Christy, but she was suffering from the mother of all hangovers and was in no shape to leave. She curled up into the comforter and mumbled something about chicken noodle soup. He leaned down and kissed her on the head and said he would be back shortly. Changing into a pair of jeans and a polo shirt, he picked through the leather tray that sat on his dresser, looking for the right folder to take. Daniel had a thing for knives and had quite the collection. He settled on a carbon fiber ZT and clipped it into his pocket, then slipped a Leatherman Wave into his back pocket with a small Phoenix flashlight. He so badly wanted to take his Glock, but in the current environment, that was just out of the question. Yes, guns were now outlawed. Daniel knew it, but he wasn't getting rid of his. He'd bought it at a gun show, and there was no paper trail to him. No one knew he had it, not even Christy. Daniel didn't think of himself as one of those chest-thumping type of patriots. He didn't go into the military. It wasn't in his family. But he was a patriot. He loved his country and the freedoms it afforded him. Seeing them diminish pained him, and he had decided to only be pushed so far. Taking the stairs down to the parking garage, he quickly made his way to the van, heading to Walmart. Traffic on this side of town was fairly light, though there was a huge police presence. It seemed that every intersection had an officer of some type sitting nearby. He made it to the store without incident. Surprisingly, the place wasn't very crowded. Maybe everyone was staying inside to watch the news. The lack of crowds let him make his rounds quickly. He hadn't really thought about how much he was putting in the cart, and by the time he made it to the register, he had a cart mounded up with stuff. As the cashier rang it all up, he stood there thinking of all the trips up and down the elevator it would take to get all this into his apartment. His hall filled a considerable amount of space in the floor of the van. On the ride back, he listened to the radio, trying to keep tabs on what was going on. Then he heard something that really shocked him. The mayor was considering a dusk-to-dawn curfew, though no official announcement had been made. Knowledgeable insiders stated it was all but a certainty. Suddenly, his trip started to make even more sense. If a curfew were started, there would be no way for him to get to the store during the week. Back in the garage, he grabbed up two handfuls of bags and headed for the elevator. It looked like he would have to make three or four more trips to get everything moved. Back in the apartment, he set the first load down in the kitchen, then had an idea and went to the closet in the living room where he kept all his camping gear. Throwing equipment over his shoulder, he finally found what he was looking for, his pack hammock, and headed for the garage again. Back at the van, he laid the hammock out on the ground beside the open door of the van and piled all the bags on top of it, then grabbed the ends and pulled them up, making what looked like a huge Santa bag. Daniel was grinning from ear to ear. This would save him a couple of trips. With great self-satisfaction, he went to throw the bundle over his shoulder and discovered it was far heavier than he had thought. With a grunt, he finally managed to get it over his shoulder, but he had to lean way forward to get the bundle into a position where he could walk under the weight. Finally making it back to the apartment, he dropped the bundle on the floor in the kitchen. He stared down at the pile spread across the floor. With a sigh, he leaned over and started to put it all away. All the cabinet doors were open, as well as the pantry. Empty shopping bags were scattered all over the kitchen, covering nearly every horizontal surface visible. Taking a quick break, he turned on the TV, back to Fox News, to see if there was any new information. What he heard couldn't be good. The governor was going to have a press conference at 4 o'clock today. He figured that if a politician was going to get on TV on a Saturday, it had to be bad news. With nothing to do for a couple of hours, he went to check on Christy. The bed was empty, and the shower was running. Back in the kitchen, he made lunch, a couple of turkey sandwiches and a bowl of chicken noodle soup. He was sitting on the couch playing Battlefield on the Xbox when she came out, drying her hair with a towel.
"Oh, that looks good. I'm so hungry," Christy said, as she sat on the couch.
"I thought you might want something to eat."
This is good. Now I see what you've been doing all morning. Boys and their video games.
Shows what you know. I just started.
I've been to the store already and bought groceries. Through bites of her sandwich, Christy asked,
"What's on the news?"
Daniel grabbed the remote and switched the TV back to cable. Fox was already on.
"Riots, riots, and more riots."
Christy wiped her mouth with a napkin.
"What happened last night?"
17 dead, or at least that's what they're saying right now.
The governor is going to have a press conference later. Maybe we'll get a little more info.
"Let's watch a movie or something. It's the weekend, and this is depressing."
"You're right," Daniel said as he leaned back and put his arm around her.
Finding a movie on pay-per-view, they spent the rest of the afternoon spooning on the couch. With Christy in his arms, he could smell her hair. While it didn't smell like the woods of North Georgia, it was an enchanting scent. And the woods will always be there. The movie was almost over when Daniel looked up at the clock. It was nearly 4. He paused the movie and switched back to Fox News. Christy didn't complain. She was obviously interested in what was going on as well. The screen displayed a podium with the seal of the governor. The talking heads were all guessing what he would say. As they waited, the screen split to show the riot that was still taking place near Tower Place. Christy shook her head.
"That's just awful. I never imagined we'd see that sort of thing here. It's like watching some other country."
Daniel squeezed her a little tighter.
"I know. Remember when Venezuela fell apart? Looks like that."
The governor stepped up to the podium, and the talking heads disappeared. He began to speak about the riots and the increasing level of lawlessness that seemed to be overtaking most of Metro Atlanta. To combat the rise in violent crime sweeping the city, he'd activated the Georgia National Guard, and they would be assuming the lead role of law enforcement in the city. To make the job easier, he was instituting a dusk-to-dawn curfew, effective immediately. Anyone caught on the streets during the curfew would be arrested, no questions asked.
"This isn't going to end well," Christy said.
Daniel grunted.
"Nope. Wish I were in the mountains."
She slapped his leg.
"What is with you in the mountains?"
Daniel pointed at the TV. "You don't have this kind of crap up there. There's fewer people, less trouble. Plus, it's probably 10 or 15 degrees cooler up there right now."
Christy stretched. "I guess I should get going so I could get home before dark." Letting her go, he sat up.
"It's so weird we're even talking about a curfew here. I mean, this is ridiculous."
Christy kissed him. "It'll be all right. You going to walk me down to the garage?" Standing up, Daniel slapped her ass.
"I hate to see you go, but I love to watch you leave."
Christy rolled her eyes. "Pathetic." The two had been together so long now that Christy had clothes at his place and he at hers. So she walked to the garage in a pair of sweats, the little black dress and heels over her shoulder in a bag. At her Honda, she tossed the bag in the seat and spun around to face him.
I had a great time, she said, as she wrapped her arms around his neck.
Me too, Daniel replied, as he leaned in and kissed her.
Better than the mountains? She asked with a wink.
Daniel looked off, as though he were mulling the question over. She slapped his shoulder.
It better have been.
He laughed and kissed her again. It was a great time. Wouldn't trade it for anything. She smiled as she got in the Honda. That's what I thought. Chapter 2. It was Monday, and back to the grind. Daniel was sitting in his cubicle, monitoring what was becoming a never-ending series of concentrated, though ineffective, attacks against the network. It was ridiculous that in this day anyone would actually try a brute force attack against a network like the banks. But for the last week, someone, or several, as was probably the case, had been trying exactly that. Daniel was shaking his head at the thought when Kilroy's head popped over the top of the cubicle. Looking up at the shiny head brought a smile to his face.
Dude, you seeing all this? Tom asked.
Daniel looked back to his monitors.
Yeah, what kind of moron tries this kind of thing nowadays?
Don't know. You track the IPs yet?
No, why don't you?
I'm locking down all the ports they probe. Let's see if we can find out where these fuckers are.
Cool, I'll do it.
Where'd you go this weekend? Tom asked.
Ended up staying home.
Tom's face screwed up.
Why? Thought you were headed north.
Let's just say Christy can be persuasive.
Tom's head cocked to the side in confusion. Then it hit him as his eyes drifted to that pic again.
Details?
In your dreams, brother. In your dreams,
Daniel said, as he swiveled around to his computer. Even though Daniel couldn't see him, Tom nodded, and his shiny head dipped below the cubicle wall. Daniel was busy trying to isolate ports in the network where the hackers were probing. It was not a very sophisticated attack, simply typing IPs into a browser window, then using one of several black market programs to try passwords until it finds one that works. The problem with that is that modern networks are protected by numerous layers of security. After only a few attempts, the firewalls and networks flag the port and lock it out. Then a human has to look at it and decide what was going on and take further action. Daniel was the human in this case. Daniel was focused on his monitors. He loved this shit. Someone was trying to get in, and he was going to stop them. He was so busy, he didn't notice Amber, who was leaning on the edge of the cubicle wall that separated him and Tom. Tom, however, did notice her. Amber had a crush on Daniel, with the pics of all the cool places he went to pinned to the walls of his cubicle, and the fact that he had a hot girlfriend. He was an irresistible conquest for her. Tom had completely stopped what he was doing. From where he sat, all he could see was Amber from the waist down. He was running his gaze up and down her legs. She was wearing the old-fashioned stockings with the seam on the back of her legs. Amber finally tried to get Daniel's attention.
Daniel, are you busy? She cooed.
Daniel didn't bother to look up. He knew from the voice who it was and wasn't interested. As hot as she was, Amber had a reputation for sleeping her way to the top.
Kinda busy. What's up?
She was holding a thumb drive, and naturally, her hand was buried between her huge tits.
Oh, sorry, I found this thumb drive in the ladies' room earlier, and I'm not sure who it belongs to.
Sorry, Amber, I'm really busy right now. See if you can find out who it belongs to.
Amber's lips formed into a fashionable pout.
Okay, I'll come by later when you're not so busy.
She straightened up and noticed Tom who tried to appear like he was looking at something tacked to the wall of his cubicle.
"What are you looking at, perv?"
she barked, and stomped off. Tom was embarrassed, turning several different shades of red. To try and cover for it, he stood up, looking over the cubicle, and asked,
"Daniel, did you track those IPs?"
Daniel spun around in his chair.
"What? You were supposed to track them down."
Flustered once again, Tom replied,
"Oh, right,"
and quickly sat down to his computer. Amber was not happy with Daniel not noticing her, and that creepy asshole Tom ogling her. She was pissed. Finding her way back to her cubicle, she threw the thumb drive onto her desk and flopped into her chair, making sure to cross her legs as she was wearing a really short skirt. She sat there for a moment, thinking about the rejection.
"One of these days, I'll get him. I'll rock his world, and he'll never go back to that skank," she thought.
She sat there for a moment, then her eyes fell on the drive. She picked it up and plugged it into her computer. It was against policy, but if it wrecked her machine, then Daniel would have to come by and fix it. A thin smile spread across her perfectly painted lips as she muttered,
"I hope it's got the mother of all viruses on it."
Daniel suddenly sat upright, running his hands through his hair. He sat there staring at the screens before him. All morning, he fought off the probes of the network, but now they were suddenly gone. He stood up, looking at the monitors, his left arm across his chest and chin in his right hand. He was interrupted by Tom.
"Dude, you stopped it. They're gone."
Daniel sat there for a moment before replying. He didn't bother to turn around.
"Either that or they're in. Did you trace the IPs?"
"Working on it," was all Tom replied, before disappearing into his cubicle again. Whoever was probing the network was using a sophisticated program that bounced the connection all over the world. It successfully masked the originating IP, but would eventually turn up, requiring some time to sort through it. Daniel and Tom would spend the rest of the week working on the project. While sifting through the trail of the IPs, Daniel kept a couple of windows open on one of the monitors. One was a local news station, and the other alternated between Fox News and CNN. The local station was dominated by the riots. After the riot over the weekend and the deaths that went along with it, the tension was building in Atlanta. Fox and CNN were showing similar video from around the country: riots, protests, and lots of police. A video of white armored vehicles caught Daniel's eye, and he turned the volume up to see what was going on. The video showed a number of vehicles that were assembling in a large parking lot. It took a few minutes to figure out where this was all taking place. Apparently, the mayor of Detroit had requested federal help to deal with the riots in that city. The number of shootings, which was already high, was climbing dramatically. Several police officers had been hit in shootouts erupting during riots in the city. People were becoming agitated. Those on the right were mad about the usurpation of their Second Amendment recognized right to own firearms. Those on the left were demanding more entitlements. Many had been energized by Bernie Sanders' campaign of socialist ideas, and they were demanding a fair and equitable distribution of the wealth of the nation. These two groups naturally clashed with one another. The police clashed with both. In the beginning, the protests over the ownership of firearms were peaceful, if not loud. But as the realization became clear that the intent was the complete disarmament of the American people, they became more violent. As for those demanding their fair share, they did as they always did. Their protests consisted of riots, looting, and arson. Typical moves from the leftist playbook. The country
was ripe for revolution. Daniel sat there chewing on the end of a pen, watching as more and more vehicles added to the mass already there. The view changed to an aerial shot where the full magnitude of the force descending on the city came into view. A line of the white vehicles stretched for blocks. A phone rang, and Daniel looked over at his. Not him, thankfully. Tom came around the cubicle.
Hey, man.
Wow, where's that?
Detroit. I wish they would come here. Things are getting out of hand around here.
Daniel swiveled in his chair.
I don't think that would be a good thing for anyone.
Yeah, well, if you're not out on the street, there's probably nothing to worry about. Anyway, Malcolm wants us in his office.
Tom raised his eyebrows and stuffed his hands in his pockets.
What for? Daniel didn't like going to Malcolm's office. While his boss was a decent guy, he never called you over just to chat.
Tom shrugged his shoulders.
Daniel levered himself out of his chair, and the two headed off to see what the boss wanted. Tom stopped outside of the office, while Daniel wedged himself past him inside and fell into one of the two chairs in front of the desk. Malcolm was just a couple years older than Daniel and had hired him for his position. Every time Daniel came into the office, he remembered that interview. With his pressed shirt and stylish yet ridiculous suspenders, Malcolm reminded him of Urkel. Now, every time he sees him, that's all he can think of.
Come in and have a seat, Tom, Malcolm said with a wave of his hand.
Tom quickly came when beckoned, taking a seat beside Daniel and folding his hands in his lap. Malcolm turned his attention to the big flat monitor on his desk for a second, before looking back and smiling.
What have you got for me?
Tom looked at Daniel.
Huh, well, I'm still working on the IPs. There were several sources of the attack. It's weird that anyone would try a brute force attack on a network like ours.
I think there is more to it, Daniel said, slumping back into the chair. Malcolm looked at Daniel. He liked the guy for his work. He was good, but he couldn't stand his obvious lack of corporate decorum.
I don't think there's more to it, really. Just some stupid hacker group, probably. But find those IPs and get back to me on it.
Did they ever get in?
No. I saw every port they tried and locked them out each time.
There were a bunch, but Tom and I stopped them. Daniel knew Tom was always worried about his job, though he didn't need to be. He did a good job, and whenever the chance arose to give him credit, he would.
Malcolm looked at his watch. It's close to quitting time. Make sure everything is secure, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Daniel and Tom nodded and left the office. On the way back to their desks, they stopped by the break room where Daniel got a Mountain Dew and Snickers bar.
Hey, thanks for backing me up in there, Tom said as he stared into the vending machine. As he opened the bottle of